This podcast is intended for mature audiences.
It also contains two British people talking about sex.
There's a hole at the bottom of the sea.
Is there?
There's a hole at the bottom of the sea.
Maybe. Where does it go?
There's a hole at the bottom of the sea. Hello! And welcome to Teabags and Joysticks, the kinky video game podcast.
I'm Chris.
And I am Sai.
How are you?
I'm okay. I'm getting by. My it's summer and somehow my sleep has gone nocturnal, so I don't know how that works. And I'm missing the British sunshine, which is, you know, as anyone who lives in England will tell you, is a rarity.
Exactly. But it's actually sunny.
Oh, no, not here. Not here.
No?
No.
Oh.
Very much overcast here.
Right.
Anyway, I think that's enough British talking about the weather.
That's fair.
How are you, Chris?
I'm doing fine. Yeah, pretty good. Nothing really happening.
Fair enough. Okay, I didn't know where that was going, but all right. What are we talking about today, Chris?
Today we're talking about the military.
We are.
We're talking about the military fetish. We're not talking about the military as in Army or Navy or the Air Force.
Or more to the point, we should say we were talking about it. So for anyone who is
correct.
A long time listener, it was, what, 4 or 5 episodes ago, maybe a bit more. You may be aware of the fact that we had to scramble for an episode because we needed to refactor an episode.
You can time it exactly when it was, because we all know when the Russian invasion of Ukraine happened.
Indeed. So this show is kind of the pickup from the show that we originally had to scramble for. We're going to jump into that interview that we did with Adam. And we will be getting into that for our tea today. But before we get there, our bag today, my apologies. But before we get there, what's the tea, Chris? Because apparently I'm ahead of myself.
Yeah. Or you're doing backwards, or I don't know what you're doing. So I have got news.
Oh?
From North Carolina.
That makes me nervous.
That a dog had been abandoned at North Carolina because his original owners thought he was gay.
Oh.
And the good news is a gay couple has adopted a gay dog.
Okay, well, that last bit's awesome, but also, what? Does it matter? You know, it's not the first time I've heard about this kind of thing, and I always look at it and I'm just like, what difference does that make?
Yeah.
But I'm glad that they've been adopted.
Yeah, exactly. The dog is called Fesco. And apparently his previous owner discovered him sexually dominating another male dog.
So I'm not an expert on dogs, but it's my understanding that if a dog's in heat, they will just screw.
Probably.
They don't give a fuck about the gender.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Probably.
I think it says a lot about the owner, but that's all I'm going to say on that.
Exactly.
Or at least the former owners, because, you know, hopefully it's happy in its new home.
Yeah. I'm sure he is. Yeah.
So do we know what breed it is?
No. I got a picture of him. I don't know if you can identify that breed, but I can't.
Honestly, probably not, because my knowledge of breeds is limited to pretty much Yorkshire Terrier, Corgis, and Huskies. Especially the Huskies. I have a soft spot for Huskies.
Mm-hmm. I know that very well, yes.
To be fair, I think anyone that knows me knows that at this point. Like, that's my pup breed. To go for a full pup sauna. Then it would be a husky.
Cool. Okay. So that's my tea. Yeah, nothing serious. Serious for the dog, of course. But,
yeah.
You know, in the grand scheme of things, what's your tea?
So I don't think we can really talk about nerd culture and be British if we don't talk about Doctor Who.
Oh, Doctor Who?
Yes. So they've announced the new Doctor.
Yeah, Doctor Who?
Hardy Ha. So yeah. Shruti Gatwa has been announced as the new Doctor who will be taking over. Is it the next episode that comes out, I think, is the plan?
You do mean the new Doctor, right?
I do mean the new Doctor, yes. What did I say?
The new Doctor Who.
That's because you've messed me up by asking me that question so many times. But yeah, so they are meant to be taking over. I believe it's the next episode we see their regeneration.
I actually don't know when that's going to happen. Yeah, probably.
So I don't actually know much about them beyond they were in Sex Education and they have won multiple awards for their acting.
Mm-hmm.
And honestly, that's about as much as I know. Which for me personally, I kind of like that.
Yeah, that's pretty good. It feels like Matt Smith all over again. Like no one knew who Matt Smith was. When he became the Doctor.
For me, it feels like Tennant all over again.
Yeah, that as well.
Because when Tennant came on, people knew him from... Oh, God, I can't remember the name of the show now. He'd done a period show for the BBC just beforehand. And everyone kind of knew him from that and was raving about how good he was and how good a choice of actor it was.
Mm-hmm.
But I had not seen that because it was a period piece, so it didn't really interest me. Everyone's been raving about how good Shruti is, having seen like Sex Education and stuff. And again, it's not one that I've seen.
Nope.
So I've kind of got this kind of really nice kind of David Tennant feeling from it. And having seen some of the interviews that they did at the BAFTAs.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm really curious to see what kind of Doctor they make him.
Yeah, it very much depends on obviously on the actor themselves, but you know, it's also down to the directors and the script writers and
It's also
production
nice,
team.
It's also nice that we're seeing a Black Doctor come in.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's going to be really interesting to see whether they acknowledge that at all with the historical stories, because that's going to be very interesting to see how that's handled. It makes me a little bit nervous, but I have quite good faith in them because they've done pretty well in handling some of this in the past. There are definitely storylines they've done it wrong.
Oh yes.
But like there are stories where they have done this pretty well in the past, and I do have fairly good faith in Russell T. Davies of being able to sit back and basically listen to guidance.
Yeah. Yeah. I haven't thought about that. Yeah, why haven't I thought about time travel in Doctor Who? That's so obvious. That's the one thing that they do.
Well, but the thing is, you say this, and I don't think I can blame you, because a lot of the recent stories have been very future based.
Yeah,
It's like either present day or future based, and it's like, okay, yeah, I can see why people wouldn't immediately leap to the historic. I really hope they do some of the historics and they get into some of that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the obvious culprits on social media have been decrying the selection. And fuck them, quite frankly.
Exactly.
I want to also put out one thing and say, I've seen a lot of people saying that Shruti is gay or queer.
Mm.
And I think it's actually important that we acknowledge Shruti has seemingly made a deliberate effort to not confirm or deny their sexual orientation.
Yep.
And I'm seeing it reported and seeing it on social media and everything going, oh, you know, is this, is that, and the other. It's just like, no, they've not said that. Let's not make any assumptions here. Do I want to see a gay doctor? Oh, God, yes. Am I going to project that on the actor? No.
No, he doesn't.
A lot of that seems to be coming from the fact that in Sex Education, he played a gay character.
Exactly. See, even explicitly gay in sex education, that role, that character, I don't even know.
I mean, again, it's not a show that I've seen. My understanding of what I've seen is that it is. But then again, I don't know how much of that is being projected onto the character because I've not seen the show.
Yeah. He definitely is not like your... the character, I mean. It's not like stereotypically kind of jocks or whatever. He, you know, he dresses like quite flamboyantly.
Mm.
But I don't know if the character is actually gay.
Fair enough. I mean, you don't have to be gay to dress flamboyantly, you know?
Exactly. And that's where all the stereotypes are coming in. That's what I'm saying.
I mean, you only have to look at sort of Roger Taylor and the rest of Queen minus Freddie Mercury that, as far as we know, are heterosexual, and then look at them in I Want to Break Free. It's just like every single one of them in drag, every single one of them, like, in fact, not just in I Want to Break Free, in a number of Queen episodes, like, oh my God, the costumes and things, which that's a whole other tea I'm going to have at some point. Like, music videos are not what they used to be, but I'll come back to that in a future tea.
No.
But yeah, that's my tea. It's just like, I don't think we can retain our, I guess, nerd credit if we don't kind of discuss that as British nerds.
Yeah, that's fair.
But no, congratulations to Shooty. I'm really looking forward to seeing how that plays out.
Yeah.
And it's nice to be excited about Doctor Who again.
Also, everybody needs to learn how to spell his name and pronounce his name.
Oh, I'm not going to lie. Like, I just said to you before we recorded this, I don't know how you pronounce his name. because I've never seen... Well, not I've never seen. I've never heard it pronounced.
No, exactly. Yeah.
So...
So, yeah. Are we into the bag?
So with that was the tea. And let's head over into the bag. So a little bit of a word of warning before we go into the bag. We are talking about military fetish and militaria. Mm-hmm. Understandably, this is going to be something that some people do find difficult. Let's acknowledge as well, this was recorded, I want to say, 3 days before Russia invaded Ukraine or thereabouts.
There or thereabouts. Yeah. Yeah, it was very, very much before when they were building up the military presence around the border, and we actually set that when we recorded.
Yeah. It was recorded at a point where it's like we didn't know if this was just saber rattling or if this was going to go that way. So mm-hmm. I want us to acknowledge that, and I want us to just put out there, it's like, yes, we're aware of this and we have waited on this. But I think it's a conversation that is definitely interesting.
It was a very interesting, yeah.
And I think there's worth in having that conversation. Unfortunately, I don't think there's ever going to be a great time to discuss military stuff, given that the world inevitably does have conflicts at any given time. We weren't comfortable putting this out when it was first recorded, so please accept our apologies for the slightly choppy nature of this show, because we're recording these things 3 months apart. But with that said, let's head into the bag. So, with the tea over, shall we head straight into the bag?
We shall do the bag, yes.
And this week we are joined by Adam. Hello.
Hello. Glad to be here.
And you are here to talk to us about militaria, which is something that I don't really have much grounding in. Like, we talked about on the kinky bucket list, that's something that I want to kind of get a bit more into. Chris, I know you have a little bit of grounding, like you're sat there in your camo right now.
Yes, I am, yeah. Got to dress for education.
But Adam, like, I think it's fair to say it's a big interest of yours?
Yeah, I think that's fair to say. I think militaria, military fetish, whatever you want to call it, can sit at entirely different levels for different people, and I think that's one of the really good things about it. People with different levels of kink, different levels of interest can connect on it. But yeah, I'd say I'm probably at the higher end of that spectrum, if we may put it that way.
Yeah. So if I was to say to you, kind of, where did it Where did it start for you? Like, how did you, like, how did you come into it, and what was it that kind of drew you to it?
I don't know how many people's journey into this was like it, but my interest in military uniform almost really started pre-fetish. I've really just, there's something about it that I've always enjoyed. I've enjoyed wearing it. I've enjoyed seeing other people wear it. And to be honest, it was really only with my kind of coming out, getting to understand my own sexuality, that I realized it could be a sexual thing. I think, like, a lot of people of roughly my age, late 2000s and early 2010s, Tumblr was a fairly big part of me discovering that not only that this weird thing that I'm kind of putting together in my head might be something that other people are interested in, and oh look, there's quite a lot of material on this. So yeah, I think that was where it came to me as a fetish. But I think in terms of a little bit of a military interest that had always been there, I think, because we should probably get onto this a little bit later on, but I think one of the things that a lot of people I know who are into this fetish struggle with a bit, like some of the other ones I know you've discussed on this podcast, is it often runs quite hard against what their own personal politics are. And in my case, I'd say that's definitely true.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. To be honest, I think that's quite common for a lot of kinks, though. Like, there's a lot of things like the humiliation scene, the degradation scene, etc. It's just like, you would never do this to somebody in a day-to-day setting. You would never want to, like, be involved with this on a day-to-day setting. But in a kink scene where everything's negotiated and everything's sort of on the up and up and everyone knows what's going on, like,
and
sure.
I think in general that is one of the great joys of kink when it's done well and properly, is that it only works if you're putting yourself into a situation where you can absolutely trust someone and you feel safe because you can trust someone to do really things that you would never explore in other areas. I think part of the reason that the military one can be so difficult is obviously, you know, war, I think we can generally agree between the three of us, is not a good thing. And often people who wear uniforms of various kinds do fairly dreadful things. But I think it also comes into, there's an interesting level of power exchange that goes with military uniforms, because it can represent either someone in a position of authority high up, or effectively the uniform exists to strip you of individual identity and agency. So it's interesting from that point of view. It can really fit into any role in the kink scene.
Yeah, that's my thing as well. Because I got my military uniform fairly early on in my kink's journey, because it is quite cheap to get hold of, like secondhand military uniform from, like,
army surplus, etc.
Army surplus store, yeah.
I don't own any, so.
I mean, eBay in this day and age would be my first port of call for anyone who's interested. But yeah traditionally, it's not very expensive.
You can get them get a pretty full gear for like less than £100, which you can never do with any other fetish, pretty much.
That's true.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Although it's definitely a gateway to spending very large amounts of money if you do choose to get into it, particularly if you decide to move into particular kit reproductions, particularly ones that may not be from your part of the world. You can then get into an interest, basically sign over your mortgage to DHL and UPS, and then spend a lot of time shipping things around the world. So while I would absolutely recommend it as a fairly low-cost gateway kink, I'd advise that it can get expensive if you let yourself dive headfirst into it.
I think that's true with any gear fetish, particularly, to be honest. Like, I mean, I don't even want to think about how much I've spent on rubber and leather. What started out as, hey, I'm going to have like this one piece because this doesn't seem that expensive, turned into, hey, that's now the most expensive thing in my wardrobe.
There are certain searches I could do in, for example, my credit card spending history that would probably bring up appalling cumulative sums. And I think we all have those types of things.
Oh, yeah. It's pretty much any interest that you can get. Like, for me, I personally think video game is a relatively cheap interest, but if you do all the collection and look for any like rare video game cartridges or something,
you're showing
like,
your age there. Cartridges?
Oh, no.
Well, no, because the Nintendo Switch still uses cartridge.
Oh, that is true.
But you mentioned there about the sort of the scope of the kink in terms of that position of power and that sort of power play that you can take from that in sort of the more sort of quote-unquote dominant sense, if you want to take it, or the more stripping of individuality. And I think it's fair to say, like, from the conversations me and you have had, you've kind of run that gamut in both directions before.
No, and like, I absolutely have. And to be honest, I think that's part of the thing that I enjoy about it. And it's a kink that offers a fairly easy opportunity for you to switch within a scene what you're doing. You and the person or people that you're with can dominate one moment, the power can switch, and I think that makes it really interesting. And I think also it really makes it quite easy for people to step into, both in terms of it being lower cost, as you've mentioned, but also it's an idea that most people have a background in. You know, you've watched war movies, you're familiar with popular culture in general, you know the basic rules of how this works, even if you're not into kink. So I think in that way, it can also be quite a good gateway for people who are interested in trying this kind of stuff for the first time and don't want to feel like a total idiot the first time they do it.
Yeah, you say pop culture, and in the back of my head I go, we're all about that age that, like, we had Action Men growing up.
Mm-hmm.
And it's one of those things that, like, because our friend Craig over at Kinky Boys has said this theory to me multiple times about how, like, the things that we grew up with seem to inform our fetishes a lot of the time. And now I'm just thinking, just the number of Action Men and things I grew up with, people I know grew up with, etc., and military fetish seems to be a fairly decently common interest in amongst guys our age. It's just like, okay, that's
yeah, that's
true. I think it was, if the period I think we all grew up in was a period for that kind of toy. I think it was also a period where, to be probably slightly blunter than I should be about it, the period where a lot of us were developing sexually, going through puberty, whatever you want to call it, was a time when there was quite a lot of war going on, you know, in the Middle East, in various other parts of the world. And so images of the military, of men in the military and all those kind of thing were very common, both in terms of the news and in terms of the type of pop culture that informed. So it was imagery and something that we were surrounded with. So, you know, it is a complete cliche. So, but in exactly the same way that kind of boarding school caning led to all sorts of fetishes among men who are significantly older than us, I do think, as you suggest, the kind of everything from Action Men through action movies will have informed this fetish for quite a number of us.
I think the military settings has a lot of kink ideas built into it anyway. A lot of the kink traditions, like calling, you know, your dominant sir and things, like, they have military backgrounds to them anyway. But, you know, soldiers, you kind of have the, you kind of just do a brainstorm, you kind of already come up with the words like loyalty, discipline, that kind of thing, you know. That's a lot of kink ideas can relatively naturally come from this theme.
Yep. And I think one of the key ones that comes for it is not, especially for those in the submissive position, not putting themselves at the centre of things. I think one of the key things in any kind of military idea is that you're serving a country, your unit, whatever it may be, but that your individual place and pleasure within that isn't what's important. It's what you form as a unit, and whether that's in terms of you serving your sir or your dominant, or if it's a bigger scene, what you can do together to serve that person, I think is a really key idea that comes out of it. I think the other thing that's probably worth touching on is a lot of other kinks, be it latex, be it the wearing of gas masks, be it leather, have certainly very military backgrounds in terms of design, in terms of what people do, and as Chris has alluded to, in terms of the words people use, the setups people use, etc.
I think that's interesting as well, because if you look at some of the other gears that we've talked about, like leather and rubber, etc., Chris, you'll remember this. One thing I was keen on with my own leather was to kind of avoid that sort of military kind of look, because while for me personally, it's not something that I have a problem with at all. Like, please don't misinterpret me, anybody. But, like, it's not a look I wanted for my leather gear. But I'd be quite comfortable doing a military scene. Like, Adam, I hope you don't mind me saying, me and you have spoken quite extensively about, like, military scenes, etc., and discussed, like, a little bit of back and forth about whether this is something that, like, I want to explore. And it's not a reservation on the military side of things. It is just that, yeah, you're right. It does filter into a lot of these, I don't want to say fashion, but sort of these visual iconographies, I guess.
Yeah, no, I think that's entirely right. And I think a lot of it is because, exactly as you've both already suggested, at the core of an awful lot of fetishes and subcultures, whatever you want to call them, sits the kind of power and control thing. Mm. And a lot of that is functioned through essentially the types of military-style rank structures, orders, etc., that have existed in society for hundreds of years. So it's not really a surprise that other bits of the cultures and institutions that basically set up the way that we treat each other in these scenarios has also filtered out, be that in terms of what people call each other or the style of the clothing that they wear. But I think it's perfectly reasonable for you to want to choose a look that says something about what your position is in any particular kink and what you want to get out of it. I think that, to go back to the point we made about people's position in kink often not representing their politics, I think that's often quite a difficult place for people to get to, and they're often having to reconcile ideas in their heads that they may not be entirely comfortable with. So I think whatever way people go down that path, people get to that place, it's entirely their choice, and it's their journey to go on.
So in terms of, because you raised an interesting thing there as well about sort of, I guess, the ethics of sort of the military and that as a fetish sort of thing, what would your take be on someone who, or more to the point, what would you say to someone, I guess, who feels a little bit uncomfortable around it because of that idea of whether you want to call it stolen valor or sort of that juxtaposition with what it can represent and how that might make them feel sort of about that? Because, I mean, so the scenario that comes to my mind is sort of, as with any fetish, sort of military fetish is a thing. So if you were to be in pride in your uniform, for example, sort of thing, as part of, you know, you're wearing that as part of your gear because you're at pride or whatever, like, what would your response to that kind of thing be?
I think with the military thing, it's a particularly difficult one. And I think in certain countries, the United States is the example that immediately springs to mind. It's one that can be really difficult. Generally, the way that most people will deal with it is that so long as it's a uniform, and it could be a uniform that comes from any particular country, but so long as it doesn't have a rank or insignia that suggests you've served in a particular conflict or achieved a particular rank or anything like that, that's okay. People can have name tapes or stuff that gives them an identity or lack of identity as they may want, but where people will generally have issues is if you are in any way trying to claim to be something you're not. Wearing military style gear that doesn't claim that kind of thing at like a pride parade or something like that, I think the kind of people who would have a problem with that are people who have wider problems with pride parades and fetishes and stuff like that, and we're not going to change their mind through stuff like this. To kind of move on to the point I think you were also making initially, the uniforms people are comfortable with is really down to them. And I think if you are in a scene with someone, you have an absolute need to make sure that they are comfortable with what you're doing. It's the same that you would negotiate any limits beforehand. The types of uniform that you wear come into that. I, for instance, regardless of the intent or what someone was saying behind it, would never be comfortable with, say, Nazi uniforms or paraphernalia being involved in a scene. It's just a barrier that I can't pass. If people do that from a particular position and I'm not involved, I'm not going to try and shut them down, but it's just, if they're doing it because they're Nazis, that's a problem. But, so long as it doesn't involve me, I think the general rule of fetish that you don't judge people who aren't actively causing you a problem or actively causing harm to themselves or anyone else does go. But I think the types of uniforms that you wear is really something to, A, be negotiated, but B, you know, if you know someone well, have a think about what their background is, where are they from, what things have their parents, relatives or something been through, and what does that mean in terms of what you can wear that will that they'll be comfortable with. And if in doubt, as with anything in kink, if in doubt, have the conversation.
I mean, I think that's a fair rule anyway. I think it's definitely something to consider as part of negotiation. Because, as you say, you don't know what someone's background is, you know? That's always a thing. And sort of, I'm just going to sort of throw my full throat support behind you there and go, yeah, I like, if you're doing the Nazi uniform stuff, no, sorry. Like, that's, no, fuck off.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, in terms of, like, negotiating with people, it really depends how well you know the other person. If you know, if it's the hookup, you're hooking up for the first time, then, you know, you probably don't know them very well, then you by all means ask those questions. Yeah, like, is this particular uniform okay? Or is this going to cause any offense? Yeah.
I mean, I think a minimum of sort of, and Adam, you'll be able to inform this more because you do this, but I think from my perspective, a minimum of like, hey, we're doing a uniform scene and this is the one I've got, is that okay? It's probably enough, I'd guess.
Yeah, I don't see why anyone would have a problem with that conversation. And I think, to be honest, the place where it can go wrong, it's probably not going to go wrong with someone like me who has basically used this fetish as a gateway to becoming a bit of a militaria nut anyway, and therefore knows about these uniforms in the background. The risk comes where someone's just picked up some camouflage that they think is cool out of Camden Market, eBay, something like that. Doesn't really know the backstory. It's not a huge risk, but I think that is the one risk, as in any fetish, that can come up when someone who enjoys it on a very casual basis comes up, not against, but comes into contact with someone for whom this is a real thing and something they research, spend money on, have spent time building a collection, and are really deeply into.
To be fair, like some military kind of camouflages creep into like mainstream fashion as well, so it's not impossible for them to pick up something like that. That doesn't actually is part of anything.
Oh no, and I mean, like, East German army jackets were a thing when I was about 17, 18, and you know, I'm sure there are many people who have a problem with the army of the former East Germany, but it was somehow just a thing. And as you say, these things can bleed into mainstream culture in odd ways. It's not common, but there are certainly examples of like what comes fairly close to 1930s, 1940s German army style paraphernalia leaking into Korean and Japanese culture in ways that a lot of people would find deeply problematic. So it's not common, but you know, I think it is just a risk. And as with any kink, do your negotiation in advance and just make sure that you ask questions. And if someone tells you no, they've told you no. It's not something for you to try and explain away. If they want to have a conversation about it and better understand it, that is fine. But as in anything else, if someone's not comfortable with it, that's on you to solve, not them.
Yep. And I think maybe there's a segue to be made here in terms of, like, what advice would you have when it comes to, I guess, ethical procurement and ethical sort of acquisition of gear, because I don't know what the correct term here is, but I think you know what I'm trying to get at.
No, I know what you mean, and I think everyone will have their own limits on what's acceptable to buy. Certainly, if you're new to this and want something fairly straightforward, the sort of British, US, German, those are the three biggest armies, do regular surpluses, stuff that's no longer in use or in many cases has never been used, gets sold off in bulk to dealers who will then sell it either online or increasingly rarely via retail stores and market stalls. And those three, putting aside any issues that people would have with these organizations, and I understand that, but will have been made in factories with reasonable working conditions that apply, that comply to decent standards. There's not kind of, within the context of you buying clothing that has been made for organizations whose job is to go into other countries and kill people, that's probably a bit blunt, but that's probably the bluntest way of putting it. Those ones are okay. Once you get outside that, things can get difficult. There's two potential forms of risk that you can look at. either you can be buying from a military like, say, Singapore or South Korea, where there's not necessarily issues with what that military does, but they are very hardcore on not letting that gear leak, which means that in some cases, if someone finds out that you have it, there's a chance of someone else getting into trouble. It's obviously pretty hard to trace that back. A lot of Singaporean gear goes out via Indonesia or Thailand, and by the time it makes it to eBay, it's long past being traced. But, you know, that is a particular risk, particularly if you're buying it off someone in that country and then exporting it. And certainly, if you do that, please make sure, for the love of God, that there are no names on it or something that someone at customs can pick up and identify that person. Then we then come on to other issues, such as the military of countries like Russia and China, who obviously the acts of those military, in China's case, well, in many places, but in Xinjiang in particular, and in Russia, Ukraine at the time of recording, and Chechnya and various other things in the past, to some people would make, you know, by buying surplus gear, you are giving money to, not necessarily directly to the army, but in the case of, say, the Chinese People's Liberation Army, most of the factories that make that gear are in some way owned by the People's Liberation Army, or in some form the Chinese government. And I think that's really a question for you to ask yourself. Now, if you've bought any clothing that's been made in China at some point, there's a fair chance that you have handed over money to a similar organization. A lot of them make other items on the side to make the books balance when there isn't a huge demand for uniforms. But some people would argue that that's much more consciously supporting those regimes and similar things than you might be otherwise. So I think, again, knowledge is power. If you know all this stuff and it's a decision you're happy to make, I'm not going to come after you, obviously. Some people you know might have particular problems if you're buying particular things, but I think the best thing you can do is find out about where the clothing comes from. Normally most sites that sell it will tell you what factory it's made in. A quick Google will give you the information you want. The third and final thing I would say is, if you're buying things from overseas, things can take a very long time to come. Countries' customs can occasionally really crack down on sending out any military type items at all, and you will probably occasionally, especially if you're into unusual militaries or anything like that, end up paying for something that either doesn't come or turns up about 9 months after you made the purchase, after you've long since forgotten about it. Sorry, that was a very long answer.
Okay. No, that's fine. Sorry. That's great. I'm just like considering everything in there. It's like, do I need to?
What was said to follow?
So, I mean, I think the other thing here is that obviously you say about sort of people shipping it and everything else and having to be like, there's ethical things to consider around all that. But I mean, there is also an element of, you are going to have people that either were or are like serving in the military, etc., that are into this, and hell, that might be one of the reasons they went into the military. Like, I have definitely spoken to a couple of people who like, one of the reasons they went into the military is they like the uniform, and like, there's all sorts of, like, because it's, when you say military to me, I always think combat uniform, but that's not all there is.
Absolutely not. And for a lot of people, I'd say probably getting a bit above a third of people, combat uniform is not the main interest, and it is the sort of more formal parade uniform. So for those who aren't familiar, they're generally a kind of plain colour, generally sort of olive green or blue, are a kind of a cross between a formal suit and almost a kind of school uniform type vibe, and often there's a little bit of crossover between people who are interested in all of those individual fetishes. And yeah, that uniform often identify someone as being of higher rank. So if someone is in a parade uniform, is doing a scene with someone in a combat uniform, it's generally the parade uniform person who have the highest rank. I think the position that it puts people who are either in the military or ex-military in can be an interesting one. I think those of us who haven't been in the military almost have a bit of a duty of care towards people who either are or have been. I think we have to remember that sometimes, particularly for those from countries with conscription, for example, their time in the military may not have been an entirely voluntary and happy experience in their lives. So I think we need to be aware of that and make sure that we're accounting for that and not pushing them into any situations like we always would, where they would feel uncomfortable. But yeah, there are people who, for whom the aesthetic of the uniform was a major attraction, or at least part of the attraction of them going into the forces. And I think what scenes often allow them to do is move out of the role that they were in, because I think, and obviously never having served myself, if we're honest, a lot of the excitement that we portray and see in the forces and we often build into these scenes may not quite exist in the way that we hope in the regular army and army service. So it's often, I think, a good chance for those people to really play about a bit with the role and bring themselves into those experiences that maybe they wanted but had not had or had rarely had. But I think it's an interesting position, and I think it's just, in terms of stolen valor and other things that you've both mentioned, something that those of us who haven't served need to be careful with.
That is something you don't get with other fetish gear. Like these uniforms are literally, you know, something that other people work in.
Yes.
These are just what they wear for work. Unlike you don't tend to wear, say, a rubber suit to work.
I mean, I'm still trying to find a workplace that will let me do that, but if you do hear one of one, let me know.
So you said there about sort of the difference between sort of, I guess, rank and positioning in terms of sort of dress uniform versus combat, etc. I think maybe that's a good time to come round a little and talk about, I guess, what kind of scene like you're looking at when you're talking sort of the military gear, etc. being involved and sort of what scenarios you're... Like, not as in, like, let's get into the specifics of, like, what it is that gets you off, but, like, what sort of, what's the thing that comes to mind? Themes. If I said to you, like, what's a typical scene?
I think it does vary a lot with people, and, like, a lot of scenes, you can do stuff that can be done in kind of quick 10 minutes or stuff that can last several days if you want to. For a lot of people, it will be a fairly casual thing. It will probably involve a lot of BDSM, a lot of... punishment, humiliation, infliction of pain, that type of thing. For a lot of people, the uniform may not stay on for particularly long. For other people, it will be on the entire time. That really varies. In other situations, people will, for example, run a boot camp scenario. That can involve stress positions. That can involve learning drill. That's particularly popular, and being punished when you do not reproduce the steps of the drill particularly well. An awful lot of stuff leads to caning, spanking, and general pain, a lot of hair pulling and stuff like that. And yes, there's often a lot of stress positions, being left standing in uncomfortable positions for a very long period of time. Effectively, if you do a military scenario, you're probably going to know about it when you move around and sit down for several days, I think is the politest way of putting it.
I feel like military scenes like always involve a lot of shouting.
Yes, I think that, I almost took that as read, but yes, a lot of shouting is a pretty key part. It comes with the humiliation. It's generally about making the person feel small, and generally about that person not being allowed to show a reaction to them being told that they're a piece of shit, effectively. So, a lot of shouting as well. I think that's a good point to make.
Fair enough. Make sure you're not in a hotel room, man.
One for when you have space and no neighbours.
Yes, I think that's a fair way of putting it, particularly if you want to use your garden.
Well, about the relationship between, you know, the dom and the sub, like, you've touched on boot camps and kind of, like, officers and kind of don, what are the non-officers, privates or something like that. Like, the one that comes to my mind, which could be a quite a common scene, is the kind of POW interrogation, those kind of scenes.
That's a very common one, and so a lot of role play can come into it. A lot of pretty beautiful work in some cases, if you look at the right scenes. People, in some cases, you'll be given a piece of information that you're not meant to disclose, and effectively disclosing it ends a scene in one way or another. Again, that involves a lot of shouting. wax plea can actually be quite a common bit of bringing some form of light torture, in the most inverted commas and consensual sense, into the scene. As I mentioned, caning, whipping, all of those types of things, often being asked to count the number of spanks, whips, canings, etc., can be a fairly common thing that happens. And yeah, often in those types of scenarios, the length is a key part of it. And very often, at the start of it, the private, submissive, whatever you want to call them, will be left waiting for a significant period of time. And that kind of sense of apprehension, sitting there in the uniform, not certain what's going to happen next, is a pretty key part of the scene.
Mm. So I mean, just as a clarification, you said beautiful there. I'm assuming you mean in the context of sort of a setup scene, not necessarily a POW situation is.
Oh, goodness, no. And I was referring particularly to like rope work that people can do. You know, that can takes a lot to learn to do that effectively. And yeah, people can be put into situations where the rope patterns on them can look particularly good, in my opinion. But yeah, I wouldn't call the POW scene beautiful, and that kind of apprehension of what's about to happen is often the major part of it. The suspense is almost as important as what follows it.
Mm. Yeah, I think that's the thing, isn't it? Like, anticipation can sometimes be a wonderful tool, like not just in a military setting, but like in a sort of fetish setting in general. That like suspense and sort of, as long as it's utilized carefully,
yes,
because it can cross that line into being abusive, but like as long as it's negotiated and it's worked carefully.
I think so long as you're clear on what like maximum time limits and things are, and you know how long you're going to be left waiting, and it's not someone absolutely taking the piss with you, then it is completely fine. But yeah, it can obviously cross lines. But I think in these types of scenarios, be it POW, be it a new recruit going to boot camp or anything like that, the kind of initial waiting, and then often, to be honest, at the end of the punishment, the interrogation, being left to sit there for a period of time at the end, can be for a lot of people a really key part of the scene and what happens.
You said something there as well, partly in that answer and partly in your previous answer, that kind of tweaked my interest, which was you said about the private, the prisoner, the sort of whoever it is being interrogated, being given a piece of information they're not meant to give up. Like, maybe this is my misunderstanding here, but like in that situation, would that information then, I guess, to some level work almost like a safe word situation? Or
I was almost about to say that and then realized I hadn't really been in any of those situations and was really just going off what I'd seen in videos. But yeah, I imagine. it could work similarly. Like many things, it's really just how you negotiate it. But yeah, certainly I've read about scenarios like that where that piece of information functions almost as a safe word. I must admit, in my if I was doing a situation like that personally, I'd want a kind of alternative safe word, so I can end the scene without feeling like you've failed, in inverted commas. But that's just me putting in as many guardrails as possible to a scene,
and I think that's a perfectly reasonable thing.
I think it really depends on your negotiation. The piece of information doesn't necessarily even have to be a safe word, you know, and some scene you can set up like you give up the piece of information and you know the and the torturers still torture you anyway because they're being sadistic, and you know that should be the setup.
I think it
really depends on
to kind of come back to where we were at the beginning. I think, like, and this goes for all kinks, but I think particularly for anyone who's new to this, we mentioned that military is often a way that people get started. There's nothing that's in your head that's a stupid thing to ask about. And I think being very clear with people, asking any questions that you have is the way to do this safely and to really enjoy it. And I think to be honest about how it makes you feel and honest about any qualms that you have about what you're doing. I know obviously that can be difficult if you are, you know, hooking up with someone, meeting someone for the first time. But honestly, a little bit of it's not always just negotiation. A lot of it is planning how you want it to go. And while, you know, you obviously want to trust people, people won't know all of your interests and how you want a situation to go the very first time that they meet you. And it's not necessarily malice. It can just be lack of knowledge. So the more you explain to that person, particularly with things like a military scenario, which can encompass a huge range of things, the more you talk, the better.
So I guess, like, my final question, unless Chris has a follow-up here, is, like, what would you say is kind of the most common, I guess, misconception, like misinformation sort of crosswire that people have when it comes to kind of military fetish and sort of that kind of scenario and gear?
I think, and it's one that comes into a lot of fetishes, but it's a misunderstanding of the type of person who's interested in this. And we came to this at the beginning. And yes, there'll be some people who are into military who fit your kind of standard person in the military sort of idea. But a lot of people who are into this can often be people who might not be fitness fanatics, who just have an interest in it, have always had an interest in it, think they look, or other people look particularly good in the gear, and have come to it that way. Really, all sorts of people come into military scenes and scenarios, and it's a really interesting sort of cross-section of people you meet, from the types of people I mentioned earlier, to ex-army people, to all sorts of different things. And I think the other misconception is that there is one particular type of scenario that people do. And yes, there are common ones, the POW and the boot camp type ones that you've mentioned, but there are really all sorts of things that people can do. And sometimes it's not even necessarily a scenario. Sometimes people just have what we might consider fairly vanilla intercourse, but just happen to wear uniforms while they're doing it. It doesn't necessarily need to be a huge setup scene. There's all sorts of ways that uniforms can figure in the way that people play and are intimate with each other.
So yeah, when I was first starting out with a military Greek gear, I was quite skinny. Let's just say, I was quite
not
skinny.
Not really, not now.
I was about to say.
Often, I was even skinnier back then. But yeah, I was very worried that it wouldn't look good in here and that kind of thing. And yes, to some extent, I still think
I mean,
that,
you're wrong, but
yeah, so Adam, do you think that you need a certain kind of type of body to pull off the military look?
I don't think so. I think, as we mentioned, there's all sorts of roles that people can play in it. I think, for example, some people like the idea of the slightly scrawny person who's just come to boot camp and has a uniform that's almost hanging off them and that they haven't quite grown into yet. And there's a scene in that. Uniforms come in all shapes and sizes, and militaries are much more open these days and take people of far more varied heights, body types, etc., which actually means the sizing of uniforms that are available are much more diverse. There are roles in certainly the UK Army where people serve in combat type uniforms but don't fight in combat, which means that they suit heights down to kind of 140, 150 centimetres and all the way up to 210. So while certainly if you're going to a regular surplus store on your high street or a market stall, you're going to find lots of uniforms that fit your kind of standard army guy type physique. If you look online, you will find something that fits you.
I'm failing that. There's always custom.
Exactly.
My mind just goes straight to skinny Steve Rogers from Captain America.
I wonder why.
But yeah, I was also thinking, like, the military is quite a male-dominated environment. So in some way, it kind of fits the whole the gay, queer kind of theme,
like the general sort of male domination of the gay and queer spaces.
Yeah. A lot of men in the military.
But I think, and Adam, hopefully, like, I think you'll agree with me on this. I hope I'm not talking out of my backside, but like, that doesn't mean that, like, if like someone is trans or trans femme, trans mask, whatever, like, they can't get into this scene as well. Because I mean, there's like, even in the modern military, like it has become, we've come a long way from don't ask, don't tell.
Yes,
basically is what I'm trying to say.
And while I would not say that there aren't problems, I think the UK military is probably one of the best at particularly LGBT plus inclusion. And I would hope that the fetish scene is accessible to people of all backgrounds, of all interests, all types of people. Certainly, while, for example, it is a very male-dominated environment, and that might suit certain type of cis male gay man. Even cis male gay men were not permitted to serve openly in a lot of Western militaries until the 2000s, 2010s, and still are not in a lot of other militaries. So it's a slightly unusual space, because yes, in many ways it fits that sort of very male aesthetic, except that men who were interested in that sort of thing were very much not welcome for the vast majority of these organizations' histories. So that does, however, mean that the work to open it up has actually meant that it's inclusive of a much wider array of people, and certainly there have been real attempts to make everyone feel welcome, not always successfully, but certainly attempts in the military, and I would hope that people involved in this fetish scene are similarly open.
I wonder whether that informs some of why it has been such a thing in the gay community as well, just because there is that thing of it's something that we for a long time couldn't do, sort of thing, in that respect.
At least not openly. Obviously, some people did in one form or another. But I do wonder if that's part of it. And I think in many ways it is an example of what has happened with the mainstreaming of certainly gay identities. I was about to say LGBT plus identities, but let's not get ahead of ourselves, unfortunately. But I do think that probably is part of it, and it all fits into the kind of curve of people, children of the 90s, and want to put it a better way, people who came of age in the kind of late 2000s, early 2010s, maybe seeing this as a fetish that they're interested in.
Yeah. In terms of meeting other people that are into this kind of stuff, because like I'm just thinking, like, if listeners are kind of listening to this, it's just like, hey, I want to kind of get a bit more into this, etc. Like, where do you tend to meet people? Is it just a case of the usual apps? Is there somewhere particular? Or
I'm not aware of any particular ones. I think the usual apps that deal with these types of things will deliver what people are looking for. I think you'll generally find people that are into this sort of gear at any particular fetish night. In some bigger cities, you will find maybe once or twice a year, maybe once a quarter if you're lucky, a particularly military fetish night. So obviously keep an eye out in the usual places to see what's going on. But it's fairly mainstream, and any kind of major fetish site will have people who are into this kind of thing.
Fair enough. Anything that we want to... Is there anything that you'd like to add, Adam?
I don't think so from here. I think the one thing I would allude back to that Chris in particular pointed out at the beginning is if you want to have a go at this, it's fairly cheap to get started. You know, if you don't mind it being for particular second-hand military gear, which is a particular interest to some people, you can kit yourself out with at least trousers and a shirt for £25-30. It's not nearly as expensive as trying other things. So if you think you might be interested, get yourself some gear and give it a go.
I think that's the bottom line with most things, isn't it? It's just like
it's just it's slightly easier to just do that than it is with some other examples.
But no, thank you very much. That's like a lot of food for thought for there, actually. Like, especially for myself, who's kind of like, do I, don't I sort of thing. Like, that's thank you very much. Like, I have took a lot from that.
Absolute pleasure.
If people wish to find you, talk to you, share thoughts, etc., is there anywhere they can do so? Like, do you want to promote anything, etc.?
They'll probably find me online eventually, but I'd rather retain the air of mystery on this appearance.
That's fair. That's completely fair. So that's it for now, I guess.
Much, Adam.
Thank you very much. Like, thank you very much for coming in. If we get any follow-up, we may potentially throw out the questions and do a follow-up episode at some point. But no, for now,
I'd be delighted
so
to
much.
Do that. Thank you so much for having me, you two.
Thank you.
All right, so that was the bag that we did about 2 months ago, 3 months ago.
Yeah, a little delayed, but I think it was one of those things where it's just like we couldn't in good conscience put it out
exactly.
when we recorded it, so
that.
It's here now.
We had to do it.
I think it was a good little chat and a good interesting insight into it, though.
I hope so.
5 minute Marvel?
Yes, I think so. We're going to be talking about Doctor Strange and this, and Moon Knight, you're going to have to wait.
Yeah, sorry. Like, we'll get into why. Roll the intro. So yeah, we both just got out of Doctor Strange.
Yes, so this will really, really date when we recorded this.
So that was a thing.
That was a thing. That was a lot.
I don't know where to start. I don't really know where to start. Like, they simultaneously did Wanda dirty while doing Wanda justice.
I know.
I don't quite know how they managed to do that, but okay.
I don't know how I feel about that. There were a lot of jump scares, more than I thought.
It was very much a Sam Raimi movie.
Yeah, it is.
I have absolutely zero complaints about that fact.
Yeah. One thing I will mention is, how many times do movies do that? Oh, you can always control that power. You have it in you all the time along.
It's a superhero trope. I know. But it's Disney. Here's the thing. That's a very X-Men trope. That is very, very much an X-Men trope.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, it's Professor Xavier in the mansion going, you can control this. You've always known how to, just you've not been focusing. So I'm not mad at that, to be honest. Because it was done in a way that made sense. I know, but she'd already shown some control over her power, so.
Yeah.
I think they did Charles Xavier dirty.
Yes, I think they did.
I'm very disappointed we didn't get some, I guess, astral plane style Charles Xavier, although it was nice to see comic book Xavier. Well, yeah. Not so much comic book, X-Men 97 Xavier.
Yeah, yeah. It's.
However.
The Illuminati was not what we thought. Well, not what.
No, it wasn't.
Thought I was, yeah. It was.
Oh, they did. Deadbolt?
Black Bolt.
Oh my god, the way they did away with him. Oh my god.
Mm.
One thing I need to get off my chest, they fucked up with Charles Xavier.
Okay.
The seat on his chair was too damn fucking high. The chair in X-Men 97, the seat isn't that high. It irritated the hell out of me every time I saw it.
Fair enough.
Also, when did Xavier leave the room? Because we never actually saw that.
Well, I don't know. At some point. I don't think there was any real conflict there. They just didn't show a thing. Didn't mean they didn't.
True. Also, did they just leave Christine to die?
No, I don't think so.
She doesn't get put down in her reality.
Yeah, I assume she went into 616 and then went back and then went again to her own universe. I'm assuming that's what happened.
I guess so, but that was weird. Yeah. I liked all the different versions of Strange. Zombie Strange was fucking creepy.
Yeah. Yeah.
I was surprised how little conflict there was between Wong and Strange about the Sorcerer Supreme stuff. There was a little bit. I was expecting a bit more back and forth on it.
I don't know. I think they've gone over it. True. I think this is kind of assumed after Spider-Man. What I'm surprised by was Spider-Man had actually like no connection to this whatsoever.
That doesn't surprise me.
The Spider-Man movie, I mean. Like, what they did in the Spider-Man movie got nothing to do with this.
That didn't surprise me, however, it set an interesting precedent regarding that. Because the whole thing about how universes colliding with it wipe it out, how many Spider-Man universes were colliding with 616?
No, I think they were specifically talking about using the Darkhold that would collide universes. I think.
My understanding was that it was whenever they crossed. Also, confirmation it is 616.
Yeah. Yeah. Rather than that stupid 19999 that they would
put in. Exactly. Yeah. Rather than the throwaway Mysterio line as well.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I'm still trying to process it, I'll be very honest. So we're probably going to end up talking about this again once I've had a chance to actually think it through.
Yeah. Oh, well. Okay. Yeah, that's done.
Go see it. That's the bottom line.
Excelsior!
I mean, if you're listening to that and you haven't seen it, well, that's on you.
I don't know what you're doing. That's your fault.
But yeah, go see it.
You know this 5-minute Marvel.
Yep. So yeah, that was the 5 minute Marvel.
Yeah. Everybody go to see Doctor Strange.
If it's still in cinemas. Well, no, actually, it should still be in
cinemas. Got to be.
Yeah, it's all right. No, because I always forget like how long things are there and what our lag time is and everything else.
Yeah, it's going to be in cinema for like 2 months.
All right.
It's going to be in cinema until Thor Love and Thunder comes out.
How? We'll get to that. That will be in a future 5 minute moment.
Yeah, okay.
Before we go on for too long. So what's on your joysticks then, Chris? Let's head into the joystick of the show.
So once again, I haven't been playing a lot of new games. In fact, I haven't been playing any new games, but I have revisited Transport Fever 2.
Okay, so you're going to have to explain this game to me because I know basically nothing of that series beyond the name of it. I'm assuming it's like a train sim type thing?
It's more like a Transport Tycoon thing.
Okay, in the sense
of... Do you know
of
Transport Tycoon?
No. But okay. Is it a Transport Tycoon in the sense of how, for example, in City Skylines, you've got to manage the whole public transport network?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so basically you've got a massive map with cities dotted around, and then you've got industries dotted around the map, and then you've got to, say, transport passengers from this city to another city, and you build a massive network,
okay.
And you also have to manage the goods from the various industries, so you've got like supply lines, or how to build... I don't know, furniture or something, and to supply the various cities with furniture, for example.
Okay, interesting. So in terms of, obviously, like you're managing the infrastructure of the transport, but is it as much of a, I guess, a resource management game? That is what powers your progression rather than necessarily pushing through... I don't know, tech trees or whatever for the different transport types? Like, is it a case of, like, you unlock different things that you need to travel to different places? Or is it a case of you progress through, like, different eras of locomotion, for example?
So there's definitely a time ticker. Like, you get to 1965, you start to get, like, diesel trains rather than steam trains, for example.
Okay.
But you also, you have to keep supplying the various resources, like, to satisfy the demand from industry, from cities, because the cities will keep growing.
Okay.
Over time. So you have to keep putting new vehicles onto the line and find ways to make it more efficient. So to start off with, you can build all the lines like pretty kind of windy because you've got less of a budget.
Yep.
Like our railway, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And when you come to like 2005 and you started like, oh, we need these like high speed lines, so you start to straighten the railway.
And just gonna plow through that mountain.
Yeah, exactly.
You see, here's the thing. I think that's one of those games that to some people that's going to sound like crack, and to other people that's going to sound like the most boring thing in the world.
Oh yeah.
And I'm very much in the former category of that, like that kind of progression for progression's sake, almost.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
As long as the grind isn't misbalanced, is always like the kind of thing that I can just get properly stuck into and properly addicted to.
Yeah. I mean, the graphics could be better. Sometimes the map looks a bit weird and the roads don't look quite right.
How old is the game? Roughly.
It's not old. It's
okay.
Like 2-3 years old.
Is it one of those games that focused very much on the gameplay loop versus graphics, though?
Yeah.
You see, that's okay by me. I'd much rather a game had a good gameplay loop than had all the sort of micro-reflective surfaces and everything else that modern gaming pushes. Because I think often
Absolutely.
We push that at the expense.
Yeah. This feels very much like the old Transport Tycoon with a 3D engine. The old Transport Tycoon being a kind of a grid-based game with very similar mechanics.
Okay. Interesting. I may have to look into that because that does sound like it'd be right up my alley.
And it's also very satisfying to just actually ride a train.
Oh, wait, you can actually like ride the trains and things in there as well?
Yeah. Okay. I mean, yeah, it's kind of on rails, so you don't get any control of the trains or anything. But yeah, you just sit out the front of the train and it just goes. And it's quite satisfying.
Oh, you see, that sounds so much up my alley. Like, I fell into a hole on YouTube about 2 weeks ago. Let me be very clear. I absolutely do not condone or encourage what I'm about to talk about.
Okay.
But people were, I think it was America or somewhere in Europe, doing what's called, I think it's called train surfing.
Hmm.
And it was basically this guy riding in the freight car of a train. Between different cities and things, and like you got to see like all the mountain view and things and the different winding tracks and everything that's used just for industrial travel versus standard coach travel stuff. So the idea of being able to just sort of jump on the train and kind of see where you've plotted all that out and everything, it's like, yeah, I could see myself like just losing time to just doing that kind of thing.
You can lose quite a lot of time.
Yeah, it's like, here's the right way to do it, sort of thing. Like, don't break any laws, just like do it in a video game.
So, yeah, anything else we want to talk about? Transport Fever?
Is it, is the mods for it?
Yes.
So I'm guessing people have added in like more recent transport innovations and things than have in the game naturally, I guess.
Yeah, so one of the things that I have actually done was to download all the British trains.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense. Because I'm guessing it's American-centric?
Into the game. No, it's not particularly anywhere-centric, actually.
Okay.
There are European trains, there are American trains, there are Asian trains, all in the game. And you can use any of them.
Fair enough. That's one thing I really like about modern gaming with PC gaming. Like, I don't play that many games on PC, but the games that I do really benefit from the modding community because they extend out the concepts.
Mm. Yeah.
Or just allow you to kind of more localize things. Like you say, downloading the British trains in City Skyline, downloading like British retail stores and things. Like, I love that about modern PC gaming.
Yeah. So what's on your joystick?
Well, kind of sticking with the same theme, actually. I can't remember if I've ever mentioned this game on the podcast before, so if I have, this is kind of a revisit, I guess, but if not, it's like a first time. I've been playing a game called Satisfactory.
Okay. And so Satisfactory.
Satisfactory. And the way I would describe this game is Factorio, but in 3D, on an alien world.
Okay, that sounds pretty much like my game. I'm like, oh yeah, Transport Tycoon, but in 3D.
Yeah.
So it's Factorio, but in 3D.
Exactly. So it's very similar. And you can actually get trains and vehicles in there as you go, and you can set automated loops and things. Mm. I'm not at that point yet. I've just seen this on like playthrough videos. That's way more advanced than what I've done. I've sunk easily 24 plus hours into this over the last couple of weeks because I finally had some free time and I've just been fully addicted to this game.
Fair enough.
Like literally just jumped on party with a few friends and just been playing this game as I've been chatting. And
I can definitely see me playing that kind of game.
It's one of
what kind of things do you make?
So you start out. So assuming you go through like all the tutorial and everything, you start out by making your base. And then you make a space elevator. Okay. And that's kind of where I'm up to at the moment. I don't know how much further you go. I just got to the point that I have got coal power. So I'm having to pump water and mine coal and everything in order to create the power loop.
Oh my god, okay.
I've had to pause my progress because I realized that my factory was so woefully like unoptimized that I'm in the process of basically rebuilding it next to what's currently running. and I'm going to like scrap everything that I've done so far and have this massive multi-story thing going off. It's very much one of those games where it's like, there's a narrative in the sense of you're an employee for this company called Fixit, and your whole thing is to get the resources. But there's not a story as such.
Okay.
The progression comes from progressing the skill tree.
Okay.
And like, it's a game of optimization, and it's one of those games that's just like, I'm a numbers guy. I'm not a numbers guy, but I'm a numbers guy. Like, I'm like, statistics and everything is my jam. Like, running this kind of like, okay, I need to make that, which means I need to have these running at this pace and this running at this pace and so on and so forth down the tree is like, that's the kind of stuff that will keep my mind ticking over. And literally, I have ended up ending my game session to lay down to go to bed and not being able to sleep because my brain is mulling over the numbers of what I need to be running on.
Okay. I feel like we have stumbled upon talking about two very similar games.
Yeah. I think you're probably right. A friend who listens to the podcast reminded me recently about what I said about Minecraft, about how like that game is like, oh, I'll just spend like half an hour doing this and I'm still there 4 hours later. This is very much the same way. Like, mm-hmm. I caution any of you that are walking into this that have that kind of time perception difficulty, I guess.
Yeah, okay, fair enough.
It very much feeds my ADHD. Let's put it that way. The other thing I'll point out is it has a really extensive modding community.
Okay.
That I haven't even begun to look at, and I'm kind of scared to. Because I'm not sure I want to fall that far down that rabbit hole.
It'll be all right.
I definitely think it's one of those games that I'm going to keep coming back to for a while.
Fair enough.
So my apologies if it crops up in joysticks again.
Fair enough. So satisfactory. I'm going to have a look at it, haven't I?
If you're the kind of person that likes that kind of thing, if you like kind of your Minecraft, if you like your sort of your resource management games, like your transport sim game, Factorio, etc., give it a look.
Never actually got into Factorio. I don't really know why. Well, I never bought the game. I've never seen people play it, and I don't know why I didn't.
I do feel like it is my kind of game. You see, I tried the demo of Factorio. And I couldn't quite get with it. I knew it had kind of the things that I like, but I couldn't quite get into the flow. Okay. Something about the way this game presents itself helped me get into the flow.
So am I right to think you're kind of playing the game from a first person kind of view?
Okay. You are in first person unless you're in a vehicle. And then in a vehicle you go into third.
Okay.
And you are looking at sort of, when you start, you're having to kind of pick apart the fauna of the area in order to create biomass to fuel your generators. And then you're having to kill some of the local wildlife and things. And it becomes this interesting, I guess it's kind of like industrialization in real time.
Yeah,
because
okay,
you can see the
weird
impact that you're having on the landscapes. And for the record, the landscapes are beautiful. Actually beautiful. So this is the second time I've properly got into it. The first time I got into it, it really freaked me out. Because I'm playing around on the ground and what have you, trying to put all my factory together, and all of a sudden there's this big shadow. And I look up to see this flying stingray type thing just blotting out the sun. And I'm like, I don't know what that is, but I want to find out. And I also kind of want to see if I can kill it.
Okay.
It's that thing of like, here's the biggest monster in the game. It's like, challenge accepted.
Fair enough. Okay. Granted, there's no killing in Transport Thief.
Well,
There's demolishing buildings, sure.
Not that you see, but those railways had to be built somehow. And early railways were not exactly safe, okay, shall we say. But yeah, that's my joystick for the week.
Okay.
But I think that's the show for this week, Chris.
Yeah, I think it is.
So if people want to find us, where can they find us?
People can find us on social media at TBNJ Podcast, and feel free to leave us a voice message at anchor.fm/TBNJ Podcast.
Indeed. And if you are on Spotify or iTunes, etc., if you could give us a rating, it would be really appreciated. But, you know, that's up to you guys what you wish to do. Once again, thank you very much to Adam for having a very interesting conversation with us about Militaria.
Indeed.
But for now, I have been Cy.
And I've been Chris.
Goodbye.
Bye. This episode is edited by TBNJ Cy. Our guest is friend of the show, Adam. The soundboard comprises royalty-free audio. The opening and ending music is Quarter Conundrum by DOAK. Thank you for listening to Teabags and Joysticks.